Before I get started this week, I wanted to give a big shout out to Jeannie Colwin Coaching. Jeannie Colwin is a highly respected and heart-centered stress and TMS coach based in LA. After enduring 16 grueling years of chronic pain and illness, she healed herself completely and now is obsessed with guiding others in her signature one-on-one coaching program. With support, consistency, and accountability, clients learn to get out of pain and heal their symptoms for good. Now, Jeannie has something special just for you, a brand new free training. Start your journey with this free 24-hour stress detox. It's a powerful mini course designed to give you a simple but effective reset. In less than 15 minutes, you'll gain evidence-based tools and step-by-step guidance to complete your own stress detox. Stress, as we often discuss on this show, is a major contributor to TMS symptoms that impact your well-being, relationships, and your career. If you're sick of feeling like this, then you deserve a detox. If you're ready to begin, check out the show notes and sign up for immediate access. A rare Tuesday episode. It is November the 26th. It is Thanksgiving week. Thank you all for joining me, the Mind and Fitness Podcast. This interview was supposed to air last week, and something funky happened with my recorder, but I'm very excited for you to hear Gabby. Now, I read one of her emails on the show a few weeks ago, and it was nice to actually have her on. So we hear all about her story as an athlete, a student athlete, and then her chronic pain issues and sort of how she's kind of reframed life beyond that. So looking forward to you listening to Gabby and I hope that you have a wonderful Thanksgiving. Let's listen to Gabby and I. Welcome back to the Mind and Fitness Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Eddie Lindenstein. It's sort of a part two, but Gabby's on the line with me. We recorded this whole thing a few days ago, and we're going to re-record it. And who knows, maybe part two will be way better than part one. What do you say?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. So we came to know each other. You had sent me over an email about a month and a half ago and had mentioned you were a recovering athlete, had some TMS issues, some back pain problems. We talked about a lot of this stuff, so I told you I'm going to try and Men in Black myself and not remember some of the things that we spoke about. But I would love to just kind of get a little bit of a synopsis, and then we can go backwards, but a little bit of a synopsis on kind of your most prevalent TMS symptom, what it was and when it was, and then we'll kind of work backwards a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'd say my most prevalent one was this bout of back pain that I had, I believe August of 2023, I think is when it started. Kind of came out of nowhere, and I grew up as a pretty intense athlete, so I was no new person to any injuries, but this was like completely different, very debilitating. I couldn't sit, I couldn't stand. And it really came out of nowhere. I didn't have like a, oh no moment of like, I felt like I pulled something or felt anything like pop. And it lasted a good, 4 or 5 months without any resolve. Saw a bunch of different doctors. Nobody really knew what was going on. I didn't have any like major diagnoses or anything like that. And that's when I, started to discover TMS work and really found myself making progress for once.
Was there, did you just wake up in the morning one day and your back was killing you?
So I I feel like lifting weights, your back gets sore every once in a while, but it feels very muscular. So I was having that for a few weeks kind of on and off. And I was like, oh, I'm probably just, overdoing it a little too much. And I remember going to bed one night and just being like, oh, this like doesn't feel right.
Yeah.
Like this is not just soreness. And, that's when the fear kicked in and I did like the doom scrolling and Googling Dr. Google. And essentially spent all night up being like, oh, I like really messed something up. So I think that also didn't help the whole spiral of TMS.
Was there any history of pain in this particular spot prior to that?
No. I'd never had any sort of back pain. I've had about every other symptom now that I think of it, but the back pain was new. And I think that back pain really freaks me out. I think it's because you can't really do anything when you have back pain.
That is the phrase, because it's, that's where, and I think that, Sarno might even talk about it in his books, but saying, that it's all the postural muscle, not all of them, but most of the postural muscles that will keep you upright are what's going on in your back. So those big spinal erectors on both sides of the spine. So anything that really is a movement of any kind, even if you're sitting, but particularly standing and walking, everything is impacted by the back. So you would say not to your back. What sort of other, you know, looking back, and I want to get into some of your athletic history too, but what sort of other, you know, just nagging types of pains did you have prior to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, of course, now that I found out about the work, did all the studying, I was like, gosh, I remember having symptoms at like 5 years old. I was had like all these crazy unexplained asthma attacks, despite being on like a good medication regimen. They were like, we don't really know why she's all of a sudden like not being able to breathe all the time. Looking back, it was definitely probably like more panic anxiety moments.
Yeah.
I was in physical therapy for knee pain at like 7 years old, which I'm like, is so wild. I like being in physical therapy as like an adult for other things. I'm like, I can't believe I was like a kid in this place. Because I feel like kids don't really have long-term pains.
Yeah.
But it was that. I've had like full body hives, different rashes that just come and go. Pretty intense like post-concussive symptoms that lasted way longer than they should have given the degree of my concussions. What else? Like plantar fasciitis, sciatica. More recently has been hip pain, which has been pretty fun. That's been a new one.
Yeah.
But yeah, honestly, anything you can list, I feel like I've had.
Okay. What kind of athlete were you? Or are you?
So I was a soccer player.
A
soccer player for as long as I can remember. I started playing like competitive traveling at age like 6 or 7.
Okay.
And played all throughout high school.
So high school is kind of where I want to go next. As an athlete, a female athlete in an athletic endeavor that's highly competitive, and I'm involved in a lot of these kind of like coaching circles for girls soccer. And I see kind of the chat and the pressure that's on kids, particularly young girls, around club or premier or select or all these different things. And it seems like a lot. Can you talk about maybe some of the pressure growing up, like being a athlete that's trying to achieve, and you know, some of the, and for some kids, it's like their family's putting a lot of pressure on them. And for other kids, it's like they're putting just that pressure on themselves, and their parents are pretty cool about it, or their families are pretty cool about it. Can you just talk about some of the pressure around being a young student athlete?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think personally, my parents could not have been like more chill. If anything, they were like, our daughter's a psycho. Like, she's crazy. I was like, I remember being like, oh, I'm going to play D1 soccer. Like the second I found out what that was, which had to have been like 7 or 8 years old. So the second I found out you could commit for soccer, I was like, well, that's what I'm doing.
All in.
If anybody's wondering. But I've always been like that, super perfectionistic, very like excessive on everything, needing to be the absolute best, even if things I like didn't care about or didn't enjoy. So a lot of that was self-inflicted. And then I also, because I wanted it so badly, like my parents did, we did scout out the best teams, the best programs. And so I think also being involved in those at a really young age and being in that environment where it's like, that's kind of what's expected of you, and that's the goal of every single player on the team, I think it just kind of solidifies like, this is what I'm doing. When you're surrounded by 18 other girls who also want to go D1, a coach who wants to be able to say, you know, they're keeping a resume of their own of how many players did I send to D1 programs. So I think on top of my own personality traits, being in an environment like that, it was intense.
Yeah.
It was a lot.
You sound like a perfectionist, or at least were. Yep. was athletics the only thing that you kind of had that, you know, kind of that gritting of your teeth and I'm going to do this like come hell or high water? Or were there other things too?
Oh, no, absolutely everything I did. Like academics, I needed to be the best at everything, which was also very tough because I had a lot of learning struggles growing up. So I think like that dichotomy of being like, I need to be the best, but I'm also like, have a few things that are literally going against me, you know, almost drove my perfectionism a little bit crazier. But no, just everything I do, I feel the need to like have it perfect. Very type A. personality.
Any, so how old are you now, if you don't mind my asking?
26 now.
So what became of your soccer career as you're, you know, we're talking about college and we're talking about D1 and we're, you know, you're playing through high school and you began, I mean, you basically had a, just by the end of high school, you had a dozen years probably in a sport. Did you go on to do any of that or?
Yeah. So I actually, my fall junior year of high school, which is like approaching the biggest season for recruiting for D1, female soccer programs, I ended up tearing my ACL, my PCL, and my LCL. So did the whole recovery process on that. It ended up being like 11 and a half months. After that, I was like, you know, I missed the most important time in order to go to D1 program. So after that, I was like, why don't I go D3? And I think after that too, I was also starting to realize, as much as I loved the sport, the mental toll it was taking on me.
Yeah.
So at that point, I kind of mentally shifted and been like, you know what, maybe D3 would be better. I could have a little bit more of a balance in my life and maybe do other things in college other than play soccer.
Yeah.
And then exactly on my year anniversary, so I had been back for like, I don't even know, maybe 6 months officially playing again, on the same knee, I did my MCL. And after that, I was like, I kind of called it quits.
Yeah.
I ended up recovering from that and playing the rest of my senior year and throughout the summer just for fun, on my team still. But I personally decided, I was like, I don't want to pursue this anymore. I'd spent so much time on crutches. It was my right leg, so I couldn't drive. So I just felt like I was stripped of my independence. And I think I was like, I don't want to do this when I'm in college. I don't want to risk being on crutches again. Like, it's already impossible to get around in a high school building with like 3 floors, let alone a college campus. And I think I was just frustrated with my body and myself. And I was like, I can't keep doing this.
So I think that the emotional toll that injuries take on athletes is really understated. Because I think that a lot of athletes tend to bury a lot of that and kind of just sort of be like pragmatic and robotic about it almost. Can you talk about your recovery on the, you know, cause like, well, maybe go to like injury day, and I'm talking the, you know, the trifecta, basically the MCL, PCL, ACL, all in, or sorry, LCL, PCL, ACL. What were you doing in that like moment? Like when that happened, like what were you doing? Do you recall?
So it was a fully non-contact injury, which is a little crazy.
Probably in basketball, that's like the worst kind of injury is the non-contact ones, it seems like.
And pretty uncommon, at least in my experience, to see that intense of an injury be fully non-contact. And I'm like wondering how much, again, like with all the TMS work, a lot of tension, a lot of, you know, things are already tight.
Yeah.
I wonder how much that was, because I definitely was overtraining, overworking myself. We were pretty, if I remember that season properly, we were pretty, what's the sports equivalent of like short staffed? I don't know why it's not coming to me. Clearly I'm in the corporate world now, but short staffed in a sports sense.
Sure.
So I remember like I was playing the full time.
You mean the players, not the staff.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Probably. Players. It's interesting you bring that up. I would say it's gotta be I don't know, thin or something like that. We had it's funny you bring, because my girls team in the spring, we had, it was a 7-on-7 format at the time, and we had 10, but there was a team that we played that had 14. And I think for that particular game, we might've had one substitute. And so like, you know, how derailed do the girls feel when the opposing coach just kind of like stops the game and says, everybody off. And then he picks the whole bench. So it's a whole fresh lineup. And then we had a couple games where there was no subs at all. Thankfully, nobody got hurt. So I can totally see that. Okay, continue. Sorry.
No, you're good. So I just remember being, you know, and it was right, it was the beginning of the season. So we had just finished preseason, which our preseasons were absolutely absurd. It was like 6-8 hours of training every day. And so I feel like preseason already like killed us. And then jumped into the season and we just had no bandwidth. So I was definitely overplaying. I was also the nuthead that was like, oh, on my days off, like I'm gonna go lift or I'm gonna go do sprints. So totally overworked. So wondering how much tension that related, but fully non-contact injury. I remember it was very loud. We were like in a stadium arena type situation, and parents at like the top of the bleachers were like, oh, we heard it.
Yeah.
Like, just a huge pop. So I think immediately when you hear something like that, you're like, oh, that's not good. And I feel like, especially being a female soccer player, like that's like the most daunting injury is like, oh, the ACL, because there's no way around the long recovery. Yep. So I immediately was like, oh, it's not good. But I was like, no way did I tear my ACL. Like that wouldn't happen to me. And then went in pretty quickly to see whatever the athletic trainer, and he was like, not feeling great about it. They do like the immediate test, but so yeah, I knew something was wrong.
Yeah.
Just in hearing how loud it was, but I think I was a little hopeful that maybe it wasn't that,
but it was,
but it
was. So yeah. I guess the recovery and kind of how you're feeling going through the recovery, is that something that you like kind of compartmentalized, or do you feel like you actually were kind of in the moment? Like, so, 'cause again, like as athletes, you're just so used to put this behind me. Like, you know, if you're a goalie and you give up a goal, like you don't have much of a choice. You have to keep playing the game. You can't really stop. But when you're an athlete that's sidelined, it's probably honestly the best advice to take a few minutes and wallow in your situation a little bit. You comment on that a little bit?
Yeah, I definitely agree that that's an important part of the process. And did I do that? Absolutely not. Like everything was in the name of getting back to play. You know, they give you the 9 to 12 month, you know, plan in your mind of, you know, you'll get the surgery and then in months 2 to 3, you'll start being able to do this. 4 to 5, you'll start. So that's all I was focused on was like, all right, kind of like the countdown, like every little progress track, you know, I was able to bend my knee an extra 2 degrees. That's awesome. Let's keep going. But I don't really remember stopping and being like, oh, this sucks. Yeah. And like, this is hard. Which I think would have been a very important step in the recovery process.
Did you end up playing in college?
I didn't. No, okay. I really just called it quits after spending so many months on crutches. I was really bitter towards the sport, which is a bummer because it's a beautiful sport and I love it. But I played like intramurals for fun, but I was pretty bitter and I was like, I don't want to be near the sport of soccer anymore.
How do you feel about that now? Is it the same feeling now?
No, I mean, I definitely still don't really like to play. I'll kick a ball around, but I don't play in any like adult leagues.
Yeah.
I think I'm still, I think part of it's also just like fearful of my body, fearful of its, you know, abilities. But I've definitely done a lot of healing with the sport. I definitely like love to watch it and love to be around it. Would love to, I know briefly after we talked last time, would love to like potentially coach little gals. So I'm definitely a lot more positive towards the sport now, but I was bitter for a while.
Yeah. Since we talked, I think I told you the story about my oldest daughter is playing basketball for the first time. She made a comment about hoping that there's a girl coach. Mm-hmm. That night that that we talked, they released the roster. So I got to see the names of all the coaches, and there are 6 fifth grade girls teams and there's only 1 female coach. So I told you it's an issue. So you should say
it is an issue.
You should consider it.
I remember thinking the same thing. Yeah. I think in all my years of playing, I think I had maybe 2 or 3 female coaches, which is a lot for you play 4 seasons a year, 18 years.
Yeah.
It's pretty wild.
Yeah, that is. Okay. So you get to college. Talk about kind of your college experience. I'm interested to hear, you know, any sort of injuries, any sort of chronic pain issues, any sort of, you know, mental health issues. Talk about that.
Yeah. All the above. I definitely got to college and was pretty, I was lost, to be honest. I'd never not played on a team before. I'd never not had a schedule of, you know, somewhere places I needed to be in terms of an athletic. So I really threw myself into, I'd always loved lifting. I did it a lot. I started lifting when I was, I think, 8 years old or something like that, yeah, for specifically soccer specific. So I started just, you know, enjoying that, kind of getting into my own routine with that. But I think I didn't, there was a lot of work mentally that I didn't do, just that I needed to do in general, given my personality traits. And then also just after all those injuries. So I became, just struggled a lot with anxiety, and that manifested in control mechanisms where I was, ended up having a really bad case with anorexia, ended up being hospitalized for that. But it was all just control based. I didn't feel like I had control in my life. So I was able to, the things that I was able to control, like food and my exercise routine, felt a lot of comfort and safety in that. So part of the healing process with that was like, maybe I decided I wanted to like pursue a personal training certification. I'd always really loved all the trainers that I worked with and was like, you know, maybe I can bring light to the space in offering a different perspective, definitely training from more of an athletic standpoint, never really a physique standpoint. Obviously that's part of it and what people want, especially as you're growing older. So I pursued my personal training certification while I was in recovery. And I think that it worked well for me because I think I was able to look at a lot of what I had done growing up. And I was like, yeah, maybe that works for a 16-year-old body, but it doesn't work for adults, and yeah, really healed my relationship with exercise and nutrition through that. But yeah, so struggle with the anorexia for a good, the worst of it was probably 2-3 years. And obviously it's going to be something that I deal with my whole life, but I am able to separate myself from it quite a bit now. And I remember having really bad sciatica in college. Never really did anything about it.
Was that during the anorexia portion, or is this after, is this before?
No, this was after. Okay. So anorexia was probably the first 2 years. And then after that, I was in a pretty good place. Still was doing all the maintenance work for it, but didn't need to be, you know, as monitored as closely. Yeah. And that's when sciatica hit. You know, I was unfortunately in college during COVID too. So COVID really threw things off. I think that's when I started to get the pretty crazy rashes, just like full body hives that would happen out of nowhere and then go away a few hours later. What else in college? Oh, I had these weird, like I had an ear infection for like 6 months. It just would not go away. And now that I think about it, it was definitely probably TMS related.
There does seem to be a, and I know you said it a few minutes ago, but it does seem like you're kind of, I love that you acknowledge the control piece, like kind of not having the control. But also, have you heard, are you familiar with the term, the symptom imperative? Has that come across your radar? Okay. Because it seems like there is a lot of that going on too. You know, you solve one problem, then you get another problem. You solve this problem and you get another problem. And I guess like, I want to go back to, or I guess we're probably approaching actually at this point, the issue of the back pain from last summer, the 23, meaning August 23. I know that you kind of went through the medical ringer a little bit on that, and it was kind of inconclusive. How did you eventually get pointed to mind body or TMS as a way, you know, as a path forward with that?
Yeah, it was actually, it was my boyfriend who brought it up, which is kind of funny because he's an engineer. He's like very literal, very science based. So I feel like when it comes to mind body stuff, he'd be the last person ever to suggest it.
Kudos to your boyfriend.
Yeah, right. I was like, good for you. You're breaking a stereotype here. But he was listening to a podcast, not mind body related at all. It's like a pop culture one. Who knows? It's random. But the host of the podcast was talking about how his wife was having back pain, and she read this book, and then she like felt a lot better. So he was like, kind of crazy that I listened to his podcast a while ago. He's like, I don't know if you want to give it a try. So I was like, you know what, at this point, and I think I was ready for it at that point. I know a lot of people talk about like, you need to be ready to do that kind of work. Yeah. And I think I was, because after seeing the number of doctors that I did and everyone being like, I don't know what to tell you, I was like, clearly something else is going on here. So I think I was ready and I was open to it. And I read The Healing Back Pain by Dr. John Sarno. And kind of like everybody says, I was like, oh yeah, like that's me on every page. I was unfortunately not one of the read the book and I was healed people. But I think a lot of it started to make sense. I'd gone through quite a bit a few years before, lots of family things. So I also think just all the theories, my personality traits, the past few years of family things, it all made a lot of sense that this big bout of pain kind of hit when it did. And so it took quite a few months of journaling, lots of like, I really found a lot of peace and grounding and breath work, meditation. Also just caring for myself at the end of the day and not, you know, putting me first, showing a lot of like self-compassion. So again, it's all still things that I need to work on clearly, because I had some hip pain a few months ago that I was dealing with. But I definitely found a lot of peace in the work.
Is there, I'm interested to hear about the self-compassion piece. Mm-hmm. I think she was either the number, like the most referred psychotherapist to Sarna, or one of the ones, but she's in New York. Dr. Arlene Feinblatt. And, in the All the Rage documentary that Michael Galinsky did, he was telling the story about how, cause he was working with her for therapy, and I think he had to miss an appointment or something. And she left him a message and said, that's fine. But remember just to be kind to yourself. And that tells me that in that line of work, that self-compassion is a big piece. So I want to hear more about that. Is there anything in particular, any tools or anything like that, that you've used or read or something, you know, along those lines in the self-compassion piece?
Yeah, absolutely. So I actually bought, so Dr. Kristen Naff is one of the like head researchers in the space. I think she's written a few books, but I purchased, it's actually in here somewhere, it's her workbook. So it's like literally the self-compassion workbook. And it's dense, it's a lot of information, but it breaks up into a bunch of different chapters. There's some like a page or two of reading that kind of explains what that chapter is about. And then it provides you a bunch of different exercises that you can do.
Yeah.
So some are meditation, some are journaling, some are like just different practices that you can do. So I found that super helpful. And, you know, just a little spoiler into the work is that self-compassion is essentially three things, like kindness, mindfulness, and common humanity. And I think just understanding that in its core has been really helpful, because in every situation that I find myself struggling, it's like you think about those three things. So how can I be kind to myself in this moment? How can I be mindful and be in this moment? And then how can I see the common humanity in this moment? And that's about like, these things don't just happen to you. Like this is a part of life.
This book, by the way, it's called Self-Compassion, The Proven Power of Being Kind to Yourself by Dr. Kristen Neff, right?
Yes.
I make this joke a lot, but it's very rare to find, let's say, 5 or 10 people that can agree on something. This book has 6,580 reviews and it's a 4.7 out of 5. So highly recommended by more than just you. What was the third one? Commonality.
Common humanity.
Yeah. There's this continuous conversation that I have with our 10-year-old where I'm not saying that like 10-year-olds don't have real problems, but a lot of times like she'll come home and like she's so upset about something, a way that someone talked to her or the way that a friend said something or whatever. And the conversation that we continuously talk about is that this stuff isn't just happening to you. Here's examples A, B, and C. And I understand that it's hard and I understand this, you know, but one thing to keep in mind is like, I know this hurts, but this is something that a lot of people are going through. So that it's funny timing, because this is a really common conversation we're having in our home as it pertains to that. Do you have any examples that you're willing to give that come to mind? And I know it's a really on the spot question, but of that thing specifically for you as you've kind of been working through it.
Yeah, I mean, I think just taking whatever, I mean, this is a really like stupid one, but I got a flat tire the other day and I was like so pissed off about it. Just, I've also had like a plethora of car problems this year and I'm already like, I hate cars. Sure. I hate driving. So it's already a pain point for me. Yeah. And I got a flat tire and I was like, of course this happens to me because, you know, this, I already hate cars and I already hate driving. And of course this happens to me. And so whatever, brought my car in. It ended up, because then, you know, I'm like, well, did I hit a curb somewhere? Like I must have done this at some point. And it ended up being like a nail that was like literally this big.
Yeah.
I'm showing my fingers, but tiny, tiniest nail. And I think that was just kind of a moment of like, there's no way I could have avoided this. Like I could barely see the nail when the guy handed it to me in my hand, let alone if I was driving. So I think just a moment like that of like, these things happen and they happen all the time and I can't beat myself up about it and I can't let it ruin my day because it's, you know, obviously it's a pain in the ass. It's stupid, like costs money, but there's literally nothing in the world I could have done other than not having gotten my car to prevent that. And so I think just being like, these things happen, flat tires happen, unfortunately, all the time, like stupid nails are everywhere.
Yep.
So just like really taking myself out of the situation and looking at the simplicity of it and knowing that it's not just like Gabby's car curse that's been continuing.
Maybe it's a, I don't know if you can draw much, but maybe a funny like little cartoon you could make is Gabby's car troubles or whatever.
Yeah.
So, okay. I'm curious on the TMS front as, because these things inevitably, one thing that Nicole Sachs says that I really, really love is that she talks about there's a cure for chronic pain. There's not a cure for human pain. And so basically what that means is like issues will probably continue to arise for the rest of your life and they'll come up in some way. It could be, you know, it could be a foot issue or it could be a back issue or it could be a wrist issue or whatever. Are there, I guess one thing I want to know, because you've been through the back thing and ultimately that's the most debilitating for a lot of people is that what is the sort of change or shift in perspective where if that happened again today, say you went to the gym in an hour and you were doing a deadlift and you suddenly had a, you know, a hot bat smack you in the back. How are you approaching it differently now with the knowledge that you have?
Yeah, absolutely. I think so. I kind of alluded to it a few times. I had like a weird, and I say weird because it's not weird. It's very, and nothing is random. I'm learning, hip pain for like a good 5 months recently. And I was been doing PT, been doing the chiropractor. And then all of a sudden it hit me and I was like, this is the same thing.
Yeah.
This is the same thing because I was doing, you know, doing everything and doing all my exercises. And it was like, it was not budging.
Yeah.
And even like my PT was like, I don't really know what to tell you. She's like, I don't, you don't need imaging. Like there's nothing, you know? And it, that's when I was like, oh, this is the same thing. And I fell into the trap again.
Yeah.
And yes, it's all a learning experience. So I'm not going to beat myself up about it, but I was like, God, the amount of time I could have saved if I just went to my journal right away. But to answer your question, I think just really anytime I'm feeling something, I'm just trying to like really think about, you know, like, what was my day like yesterday? You know, what feelings did I have? Even if it was like, oh, I got a flat tire and it pissed me off. Like things like that. Like how am I feeling? What's going on in my life? And maybe not just the day before, but like what's been going on this week? How am I feeling? So I think just immediately turning to myself first, and I can usually pick something up pretty quickly. I'm a very like out of sight, out of mind person. So I think I tend to do that in any moment where things are difficult. But looking back, I can be like, oh, yes, you know, that day at work was really tough, or like my boyfriend and I like went at it or something, even small things. So just being able to look internally first before being like, well, did I step weird? Did I squat too much weight?
Yeah.
Things like that.
I don't think anybody said it quite like that. So well done. In terms of the what was going on today or what happened yesterday or like the, I think that TMS and pain for a lot of people has a real like a recency bias, and I think it's really overlooked because a lot of times people that are kind of stuck in this chronic pain loop that seem to not have their symptoms budge. And I get emails a lot about stuff like this. And unfortunately I need to reply to them quicker, as you knew.
I don't know. You're already doing a great job. I don't know how you're doing a great job.
But a lot of times people, you know, they're like, oh, I journaled about this thing when I was six, and I, you know, kind of went over and over and over with it. But there is a real, like, a recency bias associated with that. Now, the feeling and sort of the root feeling behind, you know, that just the most minuscule thing. You go to the mailbox and the neighbor doesn't say hi to you after you say hi to them. And yes, that thing did just happen. But ultimately, how did it make you feel? Because that's the more important part, is that. We're going to wrap here in a minute, but you had mentioned this perfectionist tendencies that you had/have for a long time. How do you manage that or reconcile that now, or have you, or is it pretty much the same? Or just talk about that, because I feel like these are two trains where you have the self-compassion train that you're learning about, and then the perfectionist train, and those collide. So how do those coexist?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think I'll always have elements of being a perfectionist. I don't think I can rid myself of it fully. But I think at my core, yes, I'll always be a perfectionist. And I think, one, accepting that, not fully resisting, is also going to bring me some peace, because then I'm becoming a perfectionist about not being a perfectionist. So I think just the acceptance of, like, there are some core things that I'm never going to change, and how can I use those to my advantage in, you know, my career, in my life, whatever I want to be pursuing. But I also think layering in the self-compassion work as much as I can, and, you know, whether that's a daily practice, whether it's like, oh, I haven't done that in a week, let me go back to this, you know, read a chapter out of the journal or the workbook and take one of the practices that Dr. Kirsten Neff mentions and do them every day. So I think layering a lot of that, and it's been helpful. And I think just understanding, like, I say to myself, like, do what you can, and what you can is going to be all that matters. Things like that, if, like, yes, I can put my all towards something, but if the outcome is not exactly how I wanted, like, that's okay, because I did what I could. So kind of trying to strike that balance, not fully trying to resist my perfectionist tendencies, but almost understanding that you can't control 150%, even if you put in 200%.
Yeah.
So just trying to find that acceptance in, like, shit just happens sometimes.
Yep. Yep. Anything we haven't touched on before we wrap that's on the tip of your tongue?
No, I think we hit it all.
Okay. We'll hang on the line here, but I'll end the recording. But thank you for coming on here for a second time.
Yes, of course. thank you for being here.
Take care, Gabby.
Thanks.